Did you know the U.S. has a surplus in services with the rest of the world worth $269 billion? America's economy has changed drastically, and so has its trade relationships. There's a lot we can learn if we look a bit closer, and that's why we need a more nuanced, productive conversation on global trade. As America evolves and the global trade picture becomes more complicated, we are revisiting the debate over the topic. We'll have a special branded episode of Global Translations on June 27th, brought to you by Citi. Stay tuned wherever you subscribe to this podcast.
Okay, Ben, let me tell you a story.
Very exciting.
All right, this is a story about me in eighth grade.
Does it involve your first dance?
Yeah, no. This is a story about the late 80s in Western Canada, where I grew up. And around 1988, Canada and the U.S. were talking about entering into a free trade agreement. This was before NAFTA. And it was, like, super controversial.
Wow. So you're telling me that you were kind of a nerd in eighth grade?
Yeah, I may have been kind of a nerd. But to give you a sense, this was such a big deal in Canada that it was actually part of our curriculum to have a school-wide election around free trade. This was viewed as such a big deal in Canada. I don't even know if anyone in the U.S. noticed, but in Canada, everybody was hyper-aware.
I have absolutely no idea what you're talking about, and so no, it wasn't, I don't think. Or I was just busy doing other stuff like playing sports.
Typical. I was trying to imagine you in eighth grade. So here we were having our election, and I was assigned to be the leader of the Protectionist Party.
Wow. So you were the young Steve Bannon in this scenario.
That's not quite how I would think about it, but okay. So I was leading the Protectionist Party, and we had to come up with our campaign, and we decided to write a song. And it must have been around Christmas time, because the song we chose was The 12 Days of Free Trade, and we set it to the 12 Days of Christmas tune.
Oh, my God. All right. So what happens on day one? How do you put that to music?
Well, as you might expect, on the first day of free trade, my true love sent to me the end of environmental and labor standards in Canada.
That's too much. But you really got to sing that, I think, to sell it.
I am not going to sing. But on the second day of free trade, it was the end of Canadian agriculture and all kinds of subsidies and protections for farmers. And of course, on the third day of free trade, that was the end of Canadian culture and the end of Canadian books and movies. And by the fourth and fifth day, the Americans had come and taken all our oil. And by the end of the song, they took our water as well.
Sounds like an apocalyptic nightmare that you were describing here. I guess people were freaked out.
Yeah, it really worked.
Yeah, so I'm assuming you won.
Of course we won. And of course we learned that, you know, when it comes to campaigning and messaging around trade, it's a lot easier to scare people and make the protectionist case than it is to make a coherent case for why free trade might be good.
Louisa, that sounds an awful lot like what's played out in the United States over the last couple of years.
The politics of trade are not as simple as my eighth grade campaign, but they're not that far off. There are winners and there are losers. And today we're talking about the politics of trade in the era of Trump and whether he has scrambled the partisan politics around this issue. From Politico, this is Global Translations. I'm Louisa Savage. Ben White was just providing snark on that story. He's our chief economic correspondent. Ben, thanks for being here.
Hey, Louisa, good to be here. Snark is what I do.
Ben, you know economics and you know politics. So tell me about the intersection of those two things when it comes to the traditional coalition that supports free trade.
Right. So it used to be that you had mostly Republicans, free market Republicans who were pro free trade. You had some moderate Democrats, pro-business Democrats who were pro free trade. And then you had the giant corporations and corporate America all gung-ho about doing trade deals. So that was the historic coalition that generally got these trade deals done. But it's always been something of a moving target because the politics are weird and they're tough. And one case in point is Richard Trumka.
I'm Richard Trumka, and I'm the president of the AFL-CIO.
Which has 12.5 million members in the United States.
I came from a small mining town, company town. The company owned everything in the town except two things, the Catholic Church and the Union Hall. And so the Union Hall was the center of all of our activity.
Traditionally, the AFL-CIO is a voice aligned with progressive Democrats against free trade. But weirdly, it now finds itself, at least in some ways, aligned with President Donald Trump. In fact, there was glee in his voice when we talked to him about how he played a role in killing the Trans-Pacific Partnership deal we talked about in the last episode.
I remember before that agreement, when we were talking to President Obama, he looked me in the eyes and said, "This train's leaving the station, and you'll either be on it or you won't be on it." And I said, "We'll see how far the train gets." And he tried to align himself with those Republicans and a few other, a handful of Democrats. We were successful in having the agreement analyzed and shown its weaknesses and how it would have perpetuated a bad model, the model that started with NAFTA. And as a result, we beat it.
And he's publicly praised Trump for making changes to NAFTA, which is something Barack Obama did not do and something Hillary Clinton would not have done. He talked about it with one of our producers, Dave Shaw.
Do you get pushback from people for engaging or for saying complimentary things?
Of course.
How do you deal with that?
How do I deal with that?
Yeah.
I say, I represent my members. If I can help get a trade deal working with the president that is good for this country, good for the economy, good for our communities that because it saves their tax base, why shouldn't I do that? And if you criticize me for that, have at it. I'm fair game. I'm in the market, and I'm a big guy.
In the pre-2016 political world, the easy shorthand was when it came to free trade deals, you'd have Republicans and you'd have some Democrats, sort of the elite Democrats or the business-backed Democrats, who would push a free trade agenda, NAFTA, negotiated by President Bush, the first one, but signed by President Clinton. Have you seen a realignment of how the parties are thinking about trade and talking about trade?
Well, first, let's go back for a second. Because the way that they did that, and the Democrats helped those Republicans, was to say, if you disagree with this trade agreement, you're this dinosaur Neanderthal that is so antiquated that evolution has passed you by. Don't even talk. You're not useful. We've changed that.
Trump has aligned in a lot of ways with one of the people I spoke with, Lori Wallach.
When I started working on NAFTA and WTO, you had this philosophy that anyone who criticized these agreements was a protectionist, was an isolationist, had to be ignorant.
She's with the national consumer group Public Citizen, which was founded by Ralph Nader, and she's the director of what they call Global Trade Watch. We had this interesting conversation about how she hadn't set out looking to engage on trade, but trade found her. Lori was interested in food, but trade deals kept affecting food safety rules in the United States. And so now she spends a lot of time with people on Capitol Hill. She's been doing this for half her life. And I asked her about what the conversations were like today and how the politics had evolved given the effect that Donald Trump has had on the status quo.
I wouldn't say so much that Trump changed the Republican Party, but rather Trump appealed to that base of swing voters who really don't have a party identity. They have a set of issues and concerns identity that can be attracted to by people who will speak to what they already think and feel. While obviously President Trump has shifted the party vis-a-vis his presidency and the staff he appointed, and he's made it such that the Republicans in Congress are now in conflict between their president and their funding constituencies in the business world, that is all true. But in the countryside, I would say it has less to do with people moving their opinions or even their party affiliations, but rather they will go with whomever speaks to those issues. And that gives you the bizarre phenomenon that as a Wisconsinite, I saw repeatedly of people who voted for Bernie Sanders in the primary and Trump in the general. On the trade, corporate concentration, I'm getting screwed, economic inequality, wait, where's my recovery? The big guys win. That set of narrative threads, I think, is compelling and has been for a long time.
So now when you go to the Hill and you talk to Republican members, is it a different conversation? Have they now been shifted in response to their constituents?
I think there are two totally separate discussions going on. There's China and there's everything else. The China issue has shifted. There is an honest to God shift there, I would say, amongst policy elite, amongst policymakers, across the board. But if you look at the non-China trade agreements, just look at the TPP, there still is, I would say, amongst the Republicans for sure, amongst the foreign policy sort of elite, not with the American public, as we saw oh so well as how Trump exploited that issue to pick up states and Democratic swing Obama-Trump voters and win. But there is, with even the NAFTA renegotiation debate, the same polarization that's largely partisan, where you have the Republicans, despite it being the president's agreement, et cetera, still advocating for the business interests. And right now you have a variety of Republicans, though restrained in their tone, griping about things like they got rid of those investor tribunals that helped incentivize outsourcing. They're not going to say that in public. They're going to say a different story about why the NAFTA renegotiation is for them problematic. The Democrats have basically stuck largely on the non-China stuff to the position they've always had, which is if we can get the rules right, let's do some more trade agreements and see if we can get the benefits of trade. That's why they're in a discussion with the Trump administration. The only discussion that's actually a policy discussion that's viable is USTR Lighthizer and the Democrats in the House talking about what else would have to happen with the NAFTA renegotiated deal.
So where are congressional Republicans on trade? We grabbed Burgess Everett, who covers Congress for Politico, and asked him, is there a political constituency for this fight?
There's like a real bipartisan thirst and a surprising one to take on China and maybe weather short-term pain in farm states to sort of get a better deal from China on trade policies, on intellectual property, all of these things that a lot of people, voters, politicians think that we've been losing on for a long time.
So for people outside of the United States trying to make sense of what's happening here in Washington, do you get the impression that congressional Republicans in the House and Senate, have they shifted on trade? Are Republicans still the party of free trade?
I think that they would say yes, but I have seen a definite shift. This was not, you know, take it back 4 years ago, 2015, Republicans have just taken the Senate. What's the big thing that they do in the last 2 years of President Obama? It's to pass this TPA, this trade promotion authority that allows the president to negotiate new trade deals. The Democratic Senate of a year before that would not bring it up because Harry Reid, the majority leader then, opposed that. And so that was the substantive difference in the last 2 years of Obama's presidency, is that pro-trade Republicans with a minority of pro-trade Democrats were passing this stuff over the objections of the Democratic leader in the Senate. It was really quite unusual. And now, instead, what we get is a constant push and pull with Republicans and the President Trump, and they end up praising him for withdrawing threats that wouldn't have been there in the first place if he didn't bring them up. So it's a totally different dynamic in the party than we saw 4 years ago, and most of us didn't necessarily see trade becoming sort of the issue of the day until Trump started leading that Republican primary, in part by campaigning against NAFTA.
Do you see any substantive issues among Republicans, or is it purely the convenience of getting reelected, winning a primary, and supporting the president?
So I do think it's more of a political question than it is ideological. I mean, you know, you could even debate what a conservative is in the Trump era. A lot of folks and organizations that you would say were ideologically conservative before seem to be conservative only in the sense that they want to support the president, and that not supporting the president is not a conservative position anymore.
So one of the people who's caught right in the middle of this weird situation the Republican Party finds itself in is Chuck Grassley, a Republican of Iowa, chair of the Senate Finance Committee, and from a state that is absolutely getting slammed by a lot of the trade wars. They're a huge exporter of agricultural goods. So Grassley is worried about the impact on his home state. He's also worried about not upsetting the president and wants to support him. But it's a challenging spot for him to be in, and he's having some trouble negotiating it.
Okay, Ben, I'm ready.
I asked him if he thought it was a mistake to abandon the TPP and to go it alone with China.
It was a mistake from my point of view, but on the other hand, he ran on that and won on that. So if there's any one thing you might agree or disagree with this president on his particular policies, you got to admit and be thankful for the fact that this is a president that ran on a platform And whereas most presidents run on a platform, they don't stand on that platform. This president is standing on that platform.
Even if it wasn't a great platform?
He got elected on it. You expect people to keep their promises once they're elected.
Do you think President Trump has changed the Republican Party from a free trade party to one that's more supportive of protectionist measures?
If he believes in tariffs as a tool to get to negotiation, as opposed to being a end in themselves, then he hasn't changed anything. If he has used tariffs because he believes they're good, and I know he says that, but I don't believe he actually believes it. I don't see how he could believe it. He hasn't changed the Republican Party. We're still a party of free trade.
What gives you confidence that Trump doesn't actually believe that tariffs are a good and an end to themselves? I mean, he's been saying it for many years that they're good and that, we're bringing in hundreds of billions of dollars on tariffs. Why do you have confidence that he doesn't actually believe in tariffs as an end in themselves?
Well, I'm not in his head, so I can't answer that question. But I surely hope that he has learned from history that lower tariffs are good. Now, I have heard him say something along this line that leads me to believe that he wants lower tariffs. And that is that when we said to him several times last year, not so much recently, we don't want a trade war, he says something along the lines, what do you mean you don't want a trade war? We've had a trade war and we lost. So he wants to do something about that. And then he would say something along the lines of, well, we've had free trade since World War II. We've helped the rest of the world. We're going to look out for ourselves now. And if the rest of the world wants free trade, then let the rest of the world get their tariffs down. And I happen to agree with him on that point. For 70 years, we had lower tariffs to help revitalize the world economy after the devastation of World War II, and so we kept our tariffs low to help other countries. But now it's time that there's a level playing field for American trade.
So, Ben, would you say that Republicans are what? They're in a bind? They've been persuaded, not persuaded? What's going on in your mind with the Republicans?
I think Republicans are fooling themselves here if they think that President Trump is only using tariffs as a tool to get better trade agreements. I think he's also using them because he thinks they're really good things.
Coming up, the political balancing act facing the Democrats. More in a moment.
Global trade is complicated, but it's often discussed in a simplistic way. America is up, it's down, it's winning, it's losing. The U.S. economy looks much different than it did 30 years ago, so why hasn't our understanding of global trade changed with it?
We don't even have a common definition of what trade is today. And in fact, you know, when we look at the U.S. actually runs a trade surplus when it comes to the services component of what it does.
Yes, a surplus.
People get a little bit wide-eyed when you actually tell them that far and away the most dominant contributor to jobs or the economy or economic growth is, in fact, the services component. There's a bit of surprise there.
We'd find a lot of surprising nuances to trade if we just looked a little bit closer. I'm Carol Zimmer. Stay tuned for an upcoming special branded episode of Global Translations, brought to you by our sponsor, Citi. We will be revisiting our understanding of global trade. We'll hear from two executives of global companies who are riding the shift to services in the U.S. economy and the global economy, the CEO of Citi and the CEO of AT&T. Stay tuned for the final trade episode of Global Translations on June 27th.
This Trump trade policy is putting Democrats in an awkward position, right? I mean, here's the party that traditionally has criticized trade deals as watering down environmental and labor protections and not caring enough about domestic workers and leading to the outsourcing of jobs and offshoring. And I remember during the Democratic primary when both Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton were promising to renegotiate NAFTA. And of course they didn't, but Trump did.
100% flipping of the script. They're in this weird position of having to generally agree, most of them anyway, generally agree with what Trump is largely after, which is, you know, protecting workers and labor agreements and environmental protections, but really disagreeing strongly and sharply with the way Trump is doing it. And it's not easy for them to do.
The president's done this wrong.
We grabbed Ohio Democrat Senator Sherrod Brown in a hallway in the Capitol.
I mean, the president started off by focusing on Western Europe and Canada instead of working with our allies to focus on China. The president doesn't seem to understand that tariffs are a temporary tool to get to a long-term plan and a long-term solution. Instead, tariffs seems to be the solution to him, and it causes pain. But it causes pain for a much longer period of time to far more Americans than he needed to. I hope it works. I hope I hope that we get a good agreement out of this, but it's not clear at this point.
It's definitely an issue on the campaign trail among the two dozen or so Democratic candidates.
My name is Nihal Tusi. I cover foreign policy for Politico.
I'm Holly Otterbein, and I cover Bernie Sanders' presidential campaign for Politico.
My name is Alex Thompson. I'm the Warren Beat reporter for Politico.
We canvassed some of the members of Politico's 2020 reporting team about how trade is playing on the trail.
Bernie Sanders has already gone after Joe Biden on trade. Very shortly after Joe Biden announced his presidential campaign, Bernie started hitting him on this, started saying, you know, when Biden voted for NAFTA, I voted against it.
That Joe voted for NAFTA and permanent normal trade relations, trade agreements with China, I led the effort against
that. Biden was a vocal proponent of the TPP, I was against it. Elizabeth Warren was also against TPP.
She bucked her party's leadership back in 2016 and was very aggressively campaigning against the TPP, even while the Obama administration was going for it.
And so I think in this issue, they see both a ideological difference between Biden and the more progressive candidates such as Bernie and Warren. And they also see an opportunity to kind of like take a whack at his overall argument in the campaign that he's the most electable candidate, that he is the most likely to beat President Trump.
You know, I think if you look at Joe's record and you look at my record, I don't think there's much question about who's more progressive.
Yeah, on the campaign trail, when Warren is asked about China, she does not necessarily criticize the Trump administration's final goal with confronting China. In fact, I think she often critiques China as a bad actor on the stage. What she disagrees more is the means of his confrontation, the tweets, the disorganized nature, what she perceives to be disorganized nature of it. And so when she talks about China, she is also being quite aggressive.
The Chinese are bad actors on trade. But that means that our best way to fight back is with strength and with a coherent plan.
This is something that actually goes beyond China with regards to her and Trump, in that she sees Trump as a fake populist. But their rhetoric on a lot of issues, especially around trade and around manufacturing and the Rust Belt, is actually quite similar.
When Biden has been offered a chance to talk about China in recent weeks, he has tried to stress American strengths instead of trying to point out to the dangers China poses. He's basically been saying, look, we're America. We can take care of these guys. They are not a real threat to us. We just need to deal with them in a smart way.
You had in both parties, on the extreme left and extreme right, decide to move away from globalization. It can be harnessed. We can compete with anybody in the world.
Trump and his aides have said for so long he is the first president to really, really stand up against China. He's been willing to use sanctions. He's been willing to use tariffs. So what you have then is people saying, yes, look, he's tough. Trump is tough. He's calling them out. He knows we're going to go through some pain, but he's calling them out. Biden's side says, look, all he has to show for it is a bunch of mean tweets. He doesn't have a deal yet with the Chinese. The tariffs, they're going to hurt Americans economically in the long run. Trump is just bluster. He's just tough. Joe Biden is tough but smart.
People's opinions on trade are changing. And I think a lot of it is changing because people vote. Many voters do not like Trump, you know, in such a strong and passionate way. And so I don't know if the same dynamics are going to be there in 2020. Still, there's many, many people in the Midwest who feel as though free trade deals like NAFTA and TPP hurt them. But you also have this anti-Trump backlash going on.
Biden is trying to be tough, for lack of a better word, on China, but not lose the capacity to work with the Chinese in the long run on issues that he believes we need their help on. For instance, battling climate change. For instance, countering Iran. His point of view and his campaign's point of view is more long term. They just feel like you cannot completely alienate the Chinese because they are going to do a lot of what they're going to do. They are on the rise. They're not going to back down just because you're mean to them. So you have to find, you have to leave some space to be able to work with the Chinese. But again, that when you're talking about campaigns and sound bites, that sort of like nuanced message just doesn't work very well. It's so much easier for President Trump to be like, I'm tough on China. And when Biden comes out there and is like, well, I'm tough, but blah, 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 blah. It's just such a difficult message for voters to gobble up.
So one of the Democrats trying to thread this really difficult needle is Congressman Tim Ryan. He's from Northeast Ohio. He's one of the 24 or so people running for the Democratic nomination, though you could certainly be forgiven for not knowing that or being able to pick him out of a lineup. I ran into him at a gathering of top echelon financial and political types in Los Angeles at the Milken Institute Global Conference recently, which is a gathering of globalists. And Tim Ryan was there to talk about his own views on trade.
It sounds on China like you're at least somewhat aligned with what the Trump administration is trying to do and, you know, sort of stop what the Chinese do on intellectual property theft and forced technology transfer and just breaking the rules all over the place. Have you been supportive of their efforts in dealing with the Chinese and the way they're dealing with them?
Yeah, on some of these issues, the president has gotten the idea right. He hasn't done it the right way. But when you look at what China's doing, they have dumped steel in communities like mine. I've been fighting that for 17 years in Congress. We've got to make sure that we do enforce the anti-dumping provisions, countervailing duties for those products that are coming in. But ultimately, at the end of the day, we've got to outcompete China. And that's where the president has completely missed the mark here. We're not doing anything around electric vehicles. They dominate 40% of the market. We're not doing anything around solar. They dominate 60% of the market. AI, additive manufacturing, they're pumping money in, and we're not doing anything. And the president's asleep at the switch on these issues. So while I agree with a couple of things that he's doing, I think he has no long-term plan or agenda, and it changes day by day, which provides a lot of instability to our country, especially in rural America, where farmers haven't made a profit in 5 years and the president has made it worse.
What is the Democratic Party's position on free trade right now?
Well, I think the party has got to recognize that the trade agreements that we've signed in the past have completely wiped out communities like the ones I represent. The factories closed and went to Mexico after NAFTA. The jobs, the investment, you know, we're still feeling the consequences of that, and nobody gave a damn.
Is there a fundamental realignment of the idea that, you know, free trade is generally good, and while there's some dislocations, it ultimately leads to, you know, better economic growth and better outcomes for a lot of people? Is that now just being completely rethought, and that are we at the end of the era of free trade as a good idea in both parties in the United States, or are we just you know, trying to figure out how to do new trade deals going forward?
I think it's, you know, it's clear that trade increases wealth. The problem is it's concentrated. In the aggregate does not help Youngstown, Ohio. In the aggregate does not help Gary, Indiana, or a lot of these textile communities in the South. So a modern trade regime is going to have both an understanding of what these communities are going through, and the workers are going through, and their families are going through, and the importance of being engaged in the world. Let's have this longer term view of the world, which would include a deeper understanding of how trade affects everybody in the country.
Has the tide of globalization and, you know, reduced borders and increased free trade kind of come to an end in an era of nationalism, or is it just, you know, in realignment and in transition?
I hope it's in realignment, and I hope there is a new approach to do it. I mean, part of why why you get the backlash in Europe, in Hungary, in Poland, in America, is because we have failed collectively to address the needs of our citizens. Period. It's that simple. You can't have communities implode, and the corporate elites don't really give a shit about anybody but their bottom line, and think that somehow they're going to be able to go keep the system running that just is feeding them.
Very good. Thanks so much for your time.
Yeah, thank you.
Appreciate it.
Great. Enjoyed it.
Thanks, Ben.
Yeah. Thank you.
Take care.
But before we get to any voting in the 2020 elections, this is all about to come to a head this summer. I talked about that with Burgess Everett once again on Capitol Hill.
So if you had to write a headline on a story about where the politics of trade are headed in the Congress, what would that headline be?
I would say President Trump nears day of reckoning with Congress on trade.
Burgess says that the renegotiated NAFTA, the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement known as USMCA, is one of the few things that this divided Congress could actually pass.
You know, the next couple months will tell us pretty much everything, because once September begins, you're talking government shutdown, you're talking raise the debt ceiling. The window probably has closed for a new trade deal to be approved. And that's why I think, you know, there's not much going on in Washington today that has a chance of passing, but this is one that does. And so that's why a lot of people are starting to really hone in on it.
Okay, so just walk us through what the timeline looks like.
I would say there's an August recess is scheduled. They can always mess with that if they need to, although it's pretty sacred to members of Congress to go home for 5 weeks. But, you know, I would say by the time that Congress breaks for that August recess, whether it's at the end of July or whether they take an extra week or two, if they don't have this new trade deal approved, it's probably not going to happen.
And that's because then what in the fall?
Just too much. I mean, they have to fund the government after September 30th, then they have to raise the debt ceiling. The Democratic primary will be raging. Democrats don't generally like the new trade deals. It's just much harder to pass things the closer you get to the primary elections, which aren't that far away, honestly. I mean, we're getting close to the six-month market, and that has a way of just consuming everything in the Capitol.
So basically July or bust.
That's what I'd put a little asterisk on it and say anything could happen, but that's definitely the way that I would see it right now.
Ben, are we running out of time?
Yeah, we're absolutely running out of time to pass the USMCA. They got to get it done by the August recess. Going to be impossible to do in the fall. So, yeah, we're looking at the potential for this thing to fail, which would be potentially hugely calamitous.
And presumably that'll keep trade as a live issue and a hot political football once again in a presidential election.
Democrats are going to have to try to figure out exactly where they stand on trade. And President Trump, meanwhile, is going to try to flip the traditional script, campaign as the defender of American workers and unions and bringing manufacturing jobs back and painting Democrats as in the back pocket of Wall Street and corporate America. So it'll look a lot different than any presidential campaign we've seen in a long time.
And I'm quite sure the whole world will be watching this one. So next time on Global Translations, how are businesses and other countries sizing up everything that's going on in Washington? Plus, what to make of the man who's emerged as the leading voice on trade in the Trump cabinet, U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer.
Blathering hasn't worked for 25 or 30 years, so we have to try something new, and I think we've gotten to a point where we might have success. We'll find out.
Trump may be chaotic, but it's Lighthizer who, behind the scenes, is setting a very specific agenda. Thanks to my colleague Ben White. Our producer is Annie Reese. We had help on this episode from Patricia Jacob and Micaela Rodriguez. Dave Shaw is the executive producer of Politico Audio. I'm Louisa Savage. Global Translations is presented by Citi, a leading global bank. Subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts and listen for a branded episode from Citi about some of these same themes coming Thursday, June 27th. Thanks, and see you next week.